The Olympics are coming to a close. Have you been able to enjoy some of the sports there? Trust that you've had some opportunity to appreciate the skill of curling. That's quite an event. I heard this week that there was a doping scandal in curling. That's one I'm going to need some explanation for. I don't know about you. I don't recall an Olympics in recent history that has had such concern for cultural and international issues. With the games being in South Korea, obviously attention on North Korea, and with the United States and the tensions between the U.S. and North Korea especially, has led to a number of politicalizations, if you will, of the Olympics and the athletes there. What does this Olympics mean for international political relations? I don't recall a games in recent history that has had that angle to it. During the Cold War, the U.S. boycotted a Winter Olympics in Russia. Back in 1936, the games in Berlin were obviously politically relevant. And this games, I think, will go down as one of those Olympics where political issues rose to the surface of the games and the athletes themselves. But not just political issues outside of the athletics and the events, but cultural issues. All that we have to do is watch a bit of skating, and right before us are the sexual revolutionaries, the commentators, the athletes. This games, I think, may go down as more memorable for some in terms of the cultural relevance, besides even the political. I don't remember a games where these kinds of scenes and proud images have been displayed. To watch how certain commentators dress, to watch how certain athletes describe themselves immediately when they're interviewed. To see the United States flag with blue and white in the corner, the beautiful white stars in the blue background, but not the red and white stripes, but rainbow stripes in celebration of athletes who are homosexual. When they win, it's kind of a U.S. flag, but it's more so a celebration of sexual freedom and identity. These games are really showing that the sexual revolution has come mainstream. Now, these athletes and commentators who are homosexual or trans and want to show themselves to be this way, some of their defense and some of the defense of them from outside is that they're just being true to themselves. This is who they are. So if this is who they are, certainly it's going to be expressed in the games because they're participating. This is their job. They're working. They're making commentary. This is who they are. They're being true to themselves. And if there's a virtue in the West that is climbing the charts in terms of its esteem, it's the very issue of authenticity. And in some ways, we appreciate that, don't we? All people, I think, do to some degree, especially Christians. We want people to have freedom. We want them to have authenticity. We want to be authentic. But we understand that that's the problem, isn't it? because it's what's inside that really does come out. And if what we see on the outside is sexual promiscuity, sexual freedom, sexual selfishness in this regard, in terms of its structural perversion, then that's what's going to come out. If that's what's inside, that is what is going to be revealed. It's inside out. Last week, Jacob helped us in getting back into Luke after taking a break at Valentine's Day. If you're a guest with us, we've been walking through Luke. In 2017, we began going through Luke, and here in 2018, we find ourselves now here in chapter 11. We generally go week to week, picking up one text after another, and a few paragraphs a week in the Gospels. I think it's good to try to see the Gospels and their flow, and the units of text covered per week should be determined by flow of thought. Sometimes it might be up to a whole chapter, which may be a little harder for some of us to understand. Why not just a smaller unit? But sometimes units flow one to another, and if we can synthesize them, we get the point a little better. And sometimes we slow down if that's the flow of the text and the ideas. Certainly this is different than epistles, where in an epistle you'd perhaps do a chapter overview, but you may break it down because the thought unit is a bit smaller. But here in the Gospels, we see, and I trust that you're appreciating this in Luke, that there's a flow, that one idea leads to another, and sometimes Jesus' teaching almost begs for a real-life illustration. It's as if he makes a point, and it's almost as if, boy, if we could just have some human flesh and blood interaction to describe that point, we could really get it. And it seems that Luke never disappoints. And it does bear out his statement in Luke 1, 1-4, that many had undertaken to compose this account of Jesus' life, and Luke said, I am too. As an historian with eyewitnesses, perhaps having something like Mark or Matthew at his disposal. Also maybe information from Peter that he could put here into his gospel and putting this together. He wasn't one of the 12 with Jesus. He's rather a step removed, one who's done research and putting this gospel together. And we see that in so doing, he has woven together Jesus' teaching and events from Jesus' life to make a point of who Jesus is. And Jacob brought this up last week, the way that Jesus presents himself in Nazareth in Luke 4 when he quotes Isaiah 61, 1-2, and he says of himself that this prophecy is fulfilled now. This is the year of the Lord's favor. This is it. The time has come. In and of himself, he's reversing fortunes. The blind are receiving sight. The lame are walking. The poor have the good news preached to them. Jesus is doing these miraculous works. He's preaching with this great authority, even forgiving sins. In fact, he's weaving together, Luke is, with Jesus' works and his words, he's weaving together this gospel that presents Jesus as God's son or the most arrogant Jew in history. He's either who he says he is, or he is the most arrogant Jew in history, and he is receiving power from some demonic force. Because the things he does, no human can do. And the things he says, no Jew would. So we're left with either Jesus is who he says he is, or he is an unbelievably arrogant person. And we'll see that here today, even in Luke 11. And we understand Jesus to be God's son, the final prophet. And as such, he continues to draw attention to himself as the Messiah, as the one sent. And he draws attention to himself because he wants people to understand who he is. This is the year of the Lord's favor. Along the way, he's calling individuals to himself. He's calling people to follow after him. And this presents then discipleship. I want to think with you this morning in Luke 11 and think specifically about discipleship. What does discipleship look like in the real world? What does it look like in a day-to-day lifestyle? What does it look like in a worldview? We'll see a sequence of ideas here in Luke 11 about discipleship, and we'll begin with Jesus' use of metaphor and the idea of a lamp and how a lamp is used to describe who he is. He's been set out and he has been revealed, and the revelation that he speaks. In fact, God's revelation in him is not an exterior matter. It, in fact, reveals what's in the heart. The gospel is a revelatory revelation. It is a revelation that reveals what is inside someone's heart. And at the end of this teaching that Jesus gives, it's almost as if you want some kind of a flesh and blood illustration of it, some way that it works out. And Luke provides one in Jesus eating with Pharisees. And Pharisees are Jewish religious leaders of cultural prominence. In fact, in Jesus' view, they have made God their ladder, their precipice. They stand upon God, and their cultural prominence is, if you will, at God's expense. They use God to make themselves big. And that is a matter of concern if the Son of God has come near revealing himself. And Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees demands that we rethink concerns for cultural prominence, recasting those concerns in terms of generosity and giving ourselves away. Then we'll see a third scene where Jesus interacts with scribes. Scribes are those often of the Pharisaic larger group, but they're the real key holders. The scribes are like those running around in a culture of illiterate folks. They're the ones running around with smartphones and access to Google. They can read, most can't. And they have access to information that very few do. So they're the real power brokers. Just as we hear today, information is power, so much the more with the scribes. But instead of using that influence and that power to help people, it was mere religious speculation at times. The rabbinic traditions that tried to interpret various principles from the Old Testament and from Israel's law and apply those principles to this situation or that one can be laborious to read. In this situation, do this, but in this situation, do that. And it was very rarely with the tone of actually helping the people, a heart of love, such that the teaching was from a servant's heart that desired the good of the people, just for their good, for the good of their lives. And Jesus attacks them as well. Because discipleship in teaching has a concern for the real life of people, that things would go well for them, that their lives would be improved by God's glory according to his revelation in his word. This is discipleship in the real world, and it begins with Jesus' revelation of himself. Notice with me in the text, verse 33. Read with me down through verse 36. "No one lights a lamp," Jesus says, "and puts it in the cellar or under a basket, but on a lampstand so that those who come in may see its light. Your eye is the lamp of the body. When your eye is good, your whole body is also full of light, but when it is bad, your body is also full of darkness. Take care then," Jesus says, "that the light in you is not darkness. If therefore your whole body is full of light, with no part of it in darkness, the whole body will be full of light, as when a lamp shines its light on you. We are in the midst of Jesus' teaching here and his words, and this is a response beginning in verse 33, where we have begun as part of a response where this evil generation asks for a sign. And just imagine the way Jesus would feel, would evaluate a generation asking for a sign when he has done so many signs of who he is, when he has taught the way he has, when he has performed these miracles, he's called these individuals together, and he has enabled not only the 12, but 70 others to do the kind of acts that he has done. And they're still asking for signs. If anyone could do signs, Jesus could. And he demonstrates it by the fact that he delegates the ability to cast out demons. He delegates that ability even to his followers at times. What more do you want? This is like asking someone who is great at a certain task if they could finally do it or get it right. We think about the Olympics and the skill of some of these athletes and how well they move through the air, this half-pipe event. You know, if it would be like going to the winner of the half-pipe with skis or something and saying, could you please just start doing some gymnastics for us? Just please show us something finally? That person would be flabbergasted. What more do you want? What more do you want? Jesus says, I'm not going to play by your games. No sign will be given, Jesus says in the previous paragraph. But then Jesus accepts the sign of Jonah, which is quite a sign, isn't it? Rising from the dead's no small matter. And Jesus then begins to use metaphor. Verse 33, no one lights a lamp and puts it in the cellar under a basket. No one with great gymnastics abilities or skiing abilities would have those abilities and have opportunity at the Olympics with this huge halfpipe and not demonstrate it. Right? It would be foolish for someone who was expected to win gold, who was highly favored, had won all the championships in the last year, to show up at the Olympics and say, I'm not going to perform. Yeah, I'm healthy, but I'm just not going to do it. No one has the ability, doesn't it? No one lights a lamp and puts it in a cellar. And Jesus' point in verse 33 is that God doesn't do that either. He has lit a lamp, his son. He has set him out. No one lights a lamp and puts it in the cellar under a basket. This is the answer to those who are looking for signs. It's right here in front of you. This is not hidden. No one lights a lamp, puts it in a cellar under a basket. Rather, verse 33, where is it set out? It's on a lampstand. That's how Jesus metaphorically pictures his ministry. Sermons and signs. This is all set out public. Nothing's being done in secret. This is all for you to see. So that those who come in may see its light. It's in the transition between verses 33 and 34 that sometimes we lose track. Jesus takes this metaphor of a lamp being himself set out. It's seen. He's answering those who are wanting more signs. There's been plenty. God has set out his light, i.e. Jesus himself. But then the metaphor turns. He still uses lamp, but no longer in reference to himself. The metaphor connects a couple of series of verses, verse 33 and then verses 34 and following, but what the lamp references is different. Verse 33, Jesus, in verse 34 and following, what does the lamp reference? Something inside a disciple. Notice the text. Your eye is the lamp of the body. And here we have a complication of this metaphor. It's not just lamp anymore. Now we have eye and body included. Notice how Jesus explains this. Your eye is the lamp of the body. When your eye is good, your whole body is also full of light. But when it is bad, your body is also full of darkness. Take care then that the light in you is not darkness. Here, this lamp of the body, this revelation of the body is the eye. The eye, Jesus says, is the lamp of the body. The eye reveals what is inside. Perhaps an illustration could best help us to understand the idea. If you've ever been shopping with a gentleman, if you've been shopping with your wife or daughter or ladies, you're shopping together, you understand that when a woman goes shopping often, if she is scouting through a store, she has an ability to spot a dress, a pair of shoes, a blouse, a pair of jeans, something that she's looking for, and those catch her eye because she can see herself wearing that. I've gone shopping with my wife, some of my daughters at times, they don't take me anymore. And here's why. Because I've shopped with my wife enough, and I'll go up and I'll say, well, look at this. I've had this happen in stores. Look at this. And the look on Julie's face, it's priceless. If it wasn't directed at me, it would be even better. But I wouldn't wear that. You know, I remember distinctly early on, we were just early married or before married. What do you think of that? She just looked at me and it was like 3 seconds that was 3 hours, you know, that I would never wear that because she in her heart couldn't picture herself in that. It wasn't attractive to her eye. Think of this in terms of maybe men who would go shopping for a vehicle. And they look at this vehicle or look at that one and their eye is attracted to what their heart desires. The eye is the lamp of the body. What the eye appraises as valuable, what the eye esteems, reveals the heart's desire. The eye is the lamp of the body. What someone looks at and is attracted to, especially if it has already been illuminated, now bringing the two metaphors together, reveals what's inside. No one lights a lamp and sticks it under a basket or in a cellar. Rather, he sets it out so it gives light to everyone coming in. And the eye is the lamp of the body. Are you getting this? The reason that people are still seeking a sign from Jesus is because their hearts are bad. Not that Jesus didn't do the signs. They couldn't see because they did not want to. Do you get it? That's Jesus' point. Notice, just reading the flow of the text, no one lights a lamp and puts it in a cellar under a basket on a lampstand. That's what God has done. And your eye is the lamp of the body. Your eye, what your eye esteems or does not esteem, reveals what's in your heart, you who are asking for a sign. When your eye is good, your whole body is also full of light because the light in there has been attracted by the light outside. But when it's bad, your body is full of darkness. Take care then. Notice verse 35. Notice Jesus' statement of injunction here, what should be done, is not get better eyes. Take care then that you see better. Notice the text. What does Jesus say? Verse 35. Take care then that you see better. No. Take care then that the light in you is not darkness. His concern is not just for eyesight, it's for heart. Because the eyes are attracted to what the heart desires. The eyes notice what the heart wants. Take care then, the light in you is not darkness. If therefore your whole body, look at this, verse 36, is full of light with no part of it in darkness, the whole body will be full of light. As when a lamp shines its light on you. Verse 36. Do you see how all this fits together? Do you see how verse 36 fits with verse 33? If, therefore, the light in you is not darkness, then the whole body will be full of light, as when, a lamp shines on you. Wonder where that lamp would come from. Wonder where the imagery would come from. It's verse 33. Do you see how Jesus uses metaphor and a sequence of ideas in explaining that metaphor, moving it just a bit to explain what it's like when someone receives his revelation? It goes to the heart. That's the point. It goes to the heart and it reveals the heart. People did not want to see the signs Jesus did, i.e. recognize them, because they didn't want to submit to him in their heart. It's inside out. Joel Green writes it this way: the light in you, interpreted against metaphorical horizon, speaks to you the essential stance one has taken toward the kingdom. At stake is whether one has embraced God's purpose and serves his aim, or alternatively, whether one is governed by the dominion of Satan. Clearly, those who test Jesus, as in verse 16, as well as the Pharisees and lawyers of the subsequent unit, verses 37 to 54, whose inner avarice generate a neglect of justice and love for God, both of those groups are condemned by their own actions as people full of darkness. Why? Because they're not responding to Jesus. They're not responding to his revelation. It's almost as if this metaphorical teaching, when I read it, just begs for some concrete illustration, some way to bear out how this relationship with what's inside and outside can be better understood. And Luke provides it. Verse 37. As he was speaking, my translation says, in other words, as Jesus was answering those who demanded a sign, as he was speaking, a Pharisee asked him to dine with him. This is not the first time in Luke's gospel that Jesus has dined with a Pharisee or engaged them or spent time with them. Earlier in Luke's gospel, Jesus dined at a Pharisee's home, and there a woman came who was a sinner. Chapter 7, verse 36, one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to eat with him. He entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in the town who was a sinner found out that Jesus was reclining at the Pharisee's house, and she brought an alabaster jar of fragrant oil. And you remember the scene that Jesus enjoys the worship of this woman. She does for Jesus what the Pharisee would not do. Jesus has an association with the Pharisees. In some ways, their teachings were similar. And from the outside, if there was a Greco-Roman person just walking the streets and seeing Jesus and knowing a little about him and knowing the Pharisees, he may lump them together. They had some things in common. Jewish heritage, taught from the Jewish scriptures, concerned for these scriptures and their relevance, concerned for all the scriptures, not the Sadducees who wanted just a part of them. They were concerned for all of them and understood them to have a bearing now on the real life of the people, not just at the political level, as the Sadducees often did, but more at the boots on the ground level, that this stuff matters for us now, right here where we are. Jesus taught that way, the Pharisees did, and it would be natural for them to find out more about this itinerant from Nazareth. So he's eating with them. He's going to his home, going to the home of a Pharisee. But when he gets there, he isn't concerned about table washing. Notice verse 37, he went in and reclined at the table. The Pharisee saw this. He was amazed that he did not first perform the ritual washing before dinner. Put your finger here and jump with me back to Mark 7. Why would this ritual washing be such a big deal? Why would it even be something that an historian would write about? Why would Why would the Pharisees be concerned about it? Because ritual washing was part of the fabric of cultural prominence of the Pharisees and of the Jewish worldview. It was part of what made them unique within Rome, that gave them this cultural prominence, this uppishness about them to raise their nose at the dirty Greeks. Dirty in terms of ethnicity, but often in terms of how they behaved. Mark provides an extended portrait of this. Mark 7, pick it up with me in verse 1. Read what Mark has, especially in verses 3 and 4. The Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gather around Jesus. They observed that some of his disciples were eating their bread with unclean, that is, unwashed hands. Mark in verse 3 and in verse 4 provides an explanatory note. It's almost as if it's an aside. In a modern book, these verses might be set off in a little column shaded. Let me explain verse 3. For the Pharisees, in fact, all the Jews will not eat unless they wash their hands. And notice what Mark provides ritually, keeping the tradition of the elders. You will not find, if you scour the Old Testament, a command to wash hands. It's traditional. Verse 4, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they have washed. We think of that in terms of, yeah, Germ-X or wash your hands, kids, if you're at the store. Why? Don't want germs. And certainly that has its place. But it's more than that. Notice what Mark says. And there are many other customs they have received and keep, like the washing of jugs, cups, copper utensils, and dining couches. We think of these just in our own day as common habits of hygiene, and yes, we would be for that. But for Jews of the day, these kind of traditional and from the perspective of those around them, more scrupulous washings were connected to purity laws of the Old Testament. These were teachings that naturally extended from those to washing of hands and washing of utensils, not just for hygienic purposes, but for cultural prominence. This is who we are, and by the way, we're better than you. We are God's people, and this sets us off. It sets us off to the degree that we won't relate with you unless you do these cleansings. This becomes such an issue in Galatians that Peter is called out by Paul because there's this breaking of fellowship that Peter once ate with Gentiles, but when a delegation from Jerusalem came, he separated himself. And Paul says that in Galatians 2, even Barnabas was led away by their hypocrisy, becoming more concerned about cultural prominence and separation than about blessing the Gentiles, eating with them. Certainly there's a concern for cleanliness, but the broader issue is power. One writer states it this way: the Pharisees did not speak with a single voice. There were factions within factions. Some Pharisees were extremely wary of non-Jews and their cultural influences. Others were more liberal concerning foreign relations. Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes were influential on many different levels of society in different ways at different times. What they all had in common during Jesus' day, however, was that they operated within a system of social power that could be manipulated in their favor. If Jesus was to engage the power structures of his day, he would have to contend with these groups, and indeed that's what the Gospels reveal that he did. It's about power structures. It's about cultural prominence. It's about separation. It's about us and not them. Back with me in Luke 11 then. This is a big deal. If Jesus sits down at their place and doesn't follow their rules. It's not only rude, it's, from their perspective, akin to the kind of actions that lead to apostasy from Judaism. He didn't perform the ritual washing before dinner. So Jesus replies, verse 39, "Now you Pharisees, you clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and evil." It's here where we notice a direct connection between the lamp metaphor in verses 33 through 36 and what happens here. It's the inside that is now being revealed. It's inside out. Fools, verse 40, didn't he who made the outside make the inside too? And this becomes the very issue that Jesus gets at. You Pharisees are concerned about the outside and not the inside, and God is concerned about both. How can we deal with both? In an ethical framework, how can we deal with both? Notice what Jesus says. Give to charity, verse 41. Give to charity from what is in, and then everything is clean for you, inside and out. But woe to you, Pharisees, you give a tenth of mint and rue and every kind of herb. So scrupulous are you in your traditions of tithing that these little herbs, you're tithing those things. And all the while, you're bypassing verse 42, what? Justice and love for God. You should have done one without neglecting the other. Woe to you, Pharisees. You love the front seat in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you. You're like the unmarked graves. Unmarked graves. Unmarked graves. Do you realize how dangerous that would be for a Jew concerned about cleanliness and purity? To go near a dead body would be what? To make oneself unclean. So if you're walking over an unmarked grave, you become unclean and you don't know it. Joel Green writes that a more direct confrontation and rebuke of Phariseeism could hardly be imagined. The Pharisees, ironically, in all their striving for cleanliness, are actually making people dirty. They're unmarked graves. In their concern for washings, in their concern for cultural prominence, which washings are a part of. Again, friends, you're going to have to read the Gospels in hygiene, not from our perspective in the hand sanitizer generation, but from their perspective and what ritual washings meant for those people in that day, and how Jesus can string together ritual washings, greeting in the marketplaces, primary seats in the synagogues, and those are all under the same heading. Do you get it? It's cultural prominence. That's what they are after. This is who they are. And they have set God up as a stool that they stand upon. Jesus is concerned for the inside things. Verse 41, give to charity. Do that. Be authentic to His revelation. That's the upshot. We'll return to that in a few moments. But in the meantime, notice the scene, verse 45. The drama is ripe here. You can imagine the scene, and Jesus begins to take these folks on. Verse 45, one of the experts in the law answers, look at this. Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us too. It's almost as if, you know, it's a scribe here sitting near Jesus or something, kind of poking him. Stop it. Maybe you've done this at a meal. You have kids or something, or you've got some food hanging down, and so someone around you says, "Get that's ugly. You know, get that taken care of." Or you get kids, stop that. Stop banging your fork or whatever. Stop talking that way. Jesus, you're insulting us too. Stop making a scene. And I think he legitimately expects Jesus to shut up. Or at least change the subject. It's nice weather, isn't it, today? It's been rainy lately, sunny now. Notice what Jesus says. He attacks the scribes and the lawyers because he sees in them the very power source for Pharisaic traditions. How do the Pharisees have this information for their cultural prominence? Well, it's right here. Jesus goes after the guys running around with smartphones and internet access when no one else can read, because they're using that information to prop themselves up, to make things hard for people, and not share God's blessing to Israel, to the nations. Notice the text. Woe also to you experts in the law. It's almost, again, as if the sequence of ideas from lamp of the body to this opening with the Pharisees asking Jesus to dine to now this lawyer interrupting. It's as if each sequence builds on the other and the drama is right. And it's here's our point. Woe to you! Woe to you experts in the law! It's almost as if Jesus, right along the way, I've been waiting for this. This is the moment. You load people down with burdens. Do you realize the irony here and why this would get Jesus concerned? Why? You load people down with burdens, and you're the real gatekeepers. You're the information holders. You're the power brokers. You load people down with burdens. And Jesus said, what about himself? Isaiah 61 in Nazareth in Luke 4. He's the one preaching good news to the poor. Recovery of sight for the blind. Setting prisoners free. The year of the Lord's favor. Benevolence, kindness, wanting good things for people. You experts in the law, you load people down with burdens that are hard to carry. And notice verse 46, not only do they make it more harmful for others, they do nothing in and of themselves to help. Yet you yourselves don't touch these burdens with one of your fingers. Woe to you, you build monuments to the prophets. Notice the hypocrisy here. You build monuments to the prophets and your fathers killed them. Along the way, Jesus paints the scribes as those who think themselves to be in line with the prophets. Those who took the law and tried to apply it to the situation of the day. That's what the scribes thought themselves to be. Sort of prophetic. They took the law and tried to apply it to the situation of the day. Jesus turns it around. The scribes aren't like the prophets at all. In fact, who are they like? Those who killed the prophets. Exactly the opposite. But they're worse. They're worse. And here is where, again, I contend that if Jesus isn't the Son of God, he's the most arrogant Jew who ever lived. Notice what he does in the sequence of ideas here. He retroactives guilt. Guilt from thousands of years. Thousands of years of tradition of killing God's messengers. And he puts all of that guilt on this present generation. Those who would reject him. Notice the text, verse 47. Woe to you! You build monuments to the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Therefore, you are witnesses that you approve the deeds of your fathers. Look at the retroactive perspective Jesus takes here. And friends, this would have to be unbelievably arrogant. If Jesus is not the Son of God, you can see why the scribes and Pharisees came after him here. This is hubris. Look at what he says. You are witnesses that you approve the deeds of your fathers, for they killed them, and you build their monuments. Look at this, verse 49. Because of this, the wisdom of God said, I will send them prophets and apostles, and some of them they will kill and persecute. Look at this, verse 50. So that this generation, who does he think he is? That this generation may be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets? All the blood shed since the foundation of the world? Who do you think you are assigning guilt from other people thousands of years back onto this group?
You've either got to be just absolutely arrogant or God. Look at the text. He extrapolates the idea. At the end of verse 50, my translation has a dash. In other words, let me explain. Let me be specific. I don't want you to misunderstand. I'm going to give specific examples. From the blood of Abel, Genesis 4, to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the sanctuary, recorded in 2 Chronicles 24. And 2 Chronicles is the last book of the Old Testament in its sequence as it's presented for Jews. In other words, yes, I meant it. All the prophets, from Genesis to the end, from Genesis 4 to 2 Chronicles 24, all of them, bookends, you're guilty of all of them. Who does he think he is? This is Jesus stating he is God in the flesh to make these kinds of comments. Yes, I tell you, verse 51, notice, yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible because they are ready to kill the final prophet. Woe to you experts in the law, verse 52. You have taken away the key of knowledge. Verse 52, it's as if Jesus sees all those scribes running around with their internet access, and all the while they are not looking to see how the law can help people, how the law can set them free, how the law can do justice and love and benefit them. It's burdening. Tap, tap, tap. How can I make life better for me? How can I set myself up as an expert? How can I get power? Notice the response, verse 53. It's now we can understand why they would respond like this. Jesus left there, the scribes and the Pharisees began to oppose him fiercely, cross-examine him about many things. They were lying in wait to try to trap him somehow. Plans are in motion. Donald Hagner writes about these scribes. These lawyers were the scripture and tradition experts for the Pharisees. As experts in the law, the scribes rightly lay the burden of the law upon the people of God, but these scribes have made this into an exaggerated burden. They've not provided the support and encouragement that would have made things easier for the ordinary people. Instead of encouraging, they were inclined to despise the ordinary people who could hardly understand, let alone successfully implement, the complex legal web of requirements. A discipleship in the real world is recognizing Jesus from the heart. It's not concerned for cultural prominence or mere religious selfish speculation, but to do good, to help. I want to close noting just a couple of ideas of how we set these paragraphs right into our situation. Three ideas. The first is this. We noted it early on. Our world is a day of pursuit of authenticity. We want to be authentic, we want to be true to ourselves. That's the mantra. From Hollywood to New York, that's be true to yourself, be true to yourself, be true to who you are. As disciples, let's do the same. Yes, we're going to be true to ourselves. We're going to be true to what God has done in our lives, and we're going to go and give ourselves away. Yes, God has broken in, and light has shined in a dark place. And because of that, that's who we are. We're going to go give ourselves away. We're going to go be the people of the year of the Lord's favor. We're going to go proclaiming this good news to the poor, recovery of sight to the blind. We're going to go be who we are. Wide open, ready to be rebuked, but this is who we are. We're going to continue in love. We're going to continue in truth. We're going to continue in humility. This is who we are. We're not going to back away. This is who we are. Yes, you recognize who you are, and we understand you're trying to be authentic. If you are not a hypocrite, world, which we know sometimes that is, then let us be authentic. This is who we are. Let's go be who we are. And what will that look like? Well, it will not look like a concern for cultural prominence like the Pharisees. This is the second idea. Let's be who we are, and let's not be concerned about cultural prominence as if we're hoping someday that the culture will just look at us and approve of us or have power over the culture. Rather, the Christian campaign is underneath the culture. It's underneath it. It's to do good and to love and to serve, not cultural prominence, but cultural influence from the bottom up. It's not concerned with attention for itself. It's concerned simply to give itself away, inside out and bottom up, we could say, not top down. Christianity is never top down. Christian organizations at times have shown that to be the case. That's never the church's role. We're always bottom up. It's who we are. It's inside out. It's bottom up. Third, this is for our teaching. Our teaching is done from a servant's heart. It wants to liberate people. It wants to see good in their lives. It doesn't compromise God's word. It doesn't compromise any of what God says. But it's always done with a heart that even in hard words wants to communicate that this hard path is actually better for you, safer for you, than the wide road, than the smooth path. It's done from a heart of love, even with the hardest of words. Would you pray with me? Lord, we recognize today your greatness and what you have revealed of yourself. You have come, and it is the year of your favor, and we pray, Lord, that you will help us to seize that and to be people inside out, down up, giving ourselves away. We ask this in your Son's name. Amen.